This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the morning run continues. Julian Ng, Melissa Idris, and myself, Sharad Kutin, with the top business stories of the day. We have stock markets, foreign workers, and clouds in our crosshairs. Let's begin with AirAsia. It's set to seek a dual listing opportunity in Hong Kong before the middle of this year. Julian, why do companies do dual listings?
Yeah, that's my question as well. I'm wondering whether this will result in any benefits at all, because investors these days are very savvy and smart. And when you have savvy and smarts, aided by technology, you can really trade anywhere at the comfort of your desk. So why, you know, consider another location?
But what, okay, so not all of us are savvy and smart. Some of us might be kind of wedded to our national context.
I just wonder, okay, in this day and age, like you say, Jules, what would the benefits of a dual listing be? I wonder whether, you know, maybe you would want to dual list in somewhere where it's a different time zone, maybe access to a different market, say, you know, London or New York or whatever. Yeah. So, but Hong Kong, same time zone, same region, right?
Exactly.
The only thing I can make an educated guess about is perhaps proximity to China. Is that something that perhaps AirAsia could be considering? Why the dual listing?
Proximity to China for whom?
China investors.
For China investors. Okay, so we go back to the same investors who are savvy, smart, and aided by technology, and not referring to you, Sharad.
Sharad, who's neither savvy, smart, or...
These are professional investors whose job is to actually look at investments, right? So they would have established all the channels for them to make their trades efficiently. But Hong Kong is a different market from Singapore. I know that other Malaysian companies are hoping to also list in Singapore, established either primary listings or dual listings in Singapore, and we'll touch on that in a bit. But Hong Kong is a market that is four times the size of Malaysia. And if this AirAsia's plans to list in Hong Kong become successful, I don't know if this is going to be a snub for Bursa Malaysia. As it is already, we don't have a lot of breadth in our market. We have a lot of depth. We have enough palm oil stocks in Malaysia. We have enough banking, property, oil and gas stocks in Malaysia. But we really need the breadth of the kinds of stocks that we can buy into over here. And AirAsia is one of those very prominent tourism, low-cost budgeting play that would be very sad if we actually lost out on that. So Hong Kong, huge market, perhaps trying to attract the liquidity of that market.
Yeah, can I ask you a very basic question about the breadth issue, which is very interesting for me? What is it that we're missing in our local bourse? I mean, what kind of stocks are just not available?
Well,
I would say, okay, what about more tech stocks, right?
Tech stocks
seem to list in Australia, perhaps a little bit in Singapore. Maybe we could do more to boost tech stock listings here.
Yeah, but I mean, after having said and done all that, right, if you look across the world as well, there is also this increasing problem of the financialization of market. Most markets are very heavily weighted by banks and financial institutions. So maybe I'm just barking up the wrong tree, but I would like to see in Malaysia a more diversified industries to allow people to invest in.
Julian, are you barking up a rubber tree? And I'm asking this because we know that there's some companies that have in fact done dual listings, Top Glove being one of them. And what was the experience of that?
Yeah, Top Glove, I think they don't necessarily just bark up the rubber tree. They probably are involved in a lot of synthetic
nitrile gloves.
as well as latex as well. They've listed in Singapore as of June last year, and I don't think I see any significant effects on the volume that is being traded. I don't see it increasing and improving on the liquidity of Top Glove, because you're talking about average daily volumes of around just 600 shares compared to 2 million shares on Bursa Malaysia. So this is extra cost, extra reporting standards to fulfill. Mm-hmm. You know, so the question is, why do that? And we also see news of Papa Rich having plans to IPO in Singapore. I mean, this iconic Malaysian company, right?
I feel quite hurt by this news simply because I'm a patron of Papa Rich.
They're not going to stop selling food in Malaysia, Melissa.
But look, I mean, this is a quintessential Malaysian brand, right? It sells Malaysian food. It's been started here many years ago, I think about a decade ago, 10 years ago. And it's got so many outlets here and abroad. I remember being in Australia, or I can't remember where it was, that I went to a Papa Rich and went, oh my God, a taste of home.
Even
I was one
London,
of those
I think,
terrible Malaysians I think that look for nasi lemak when I'm abroad.
I think in London there is a Papa Roti.
Okay. All right. I don't know what
Julian,
that's
to play on Pavarotti.
Julian, is
Pavarotti? I just got that.
Okay. Very clever, guys. Thank you very much. You get a gold star for that. The question of when you list, you already done the listing in Malaysia, and then you go abroad. And say, are you kind of like trying to double dip? Is it too late? Should you, like Papa Rich, begin your first IPO in a market or boss that you think is going to give you the best yields?
I don't know if there are reputational factors at play here. For example, the Chinese government wants to expose a lot more of their SOEs, the state-owned enterprises, to international scrutiny, and therefore preparing a lot of these huge SOEs to list in Hong Kong, for example, and also opening up the Chinese market to a lot more international investors through the SNOC, the so-called Stock Connect, right? Where international investors can buy directly into Chinese-listed companies where they couldn't before. Grab, for example, another iconic Malaysian started company, is headquartered in Singapore. And has that got to do with the more credible rules and regulations that they have there that international investors like? So I don't know whether on the side of Malaysia we can improve on that. I'm sure SC would have a thing or two to say about that.
But yet, SC has said that, you know, they're expecting companies to raise between 90 to 105 billion ringgit in capital this year, both through the bond market and also capital markets, right? Through IPOs.
So the first takeaway from this that I observe is that 105 billion is almost the same as the amount that was raised last year in the capital market. Last year was, I think, around 100 million. So is this a vote of confidence for the market? I don't know. I mean, to be able to maintain that kind of huge raisings is very good, I think. Yeah. And if investors actually absorb all that 105 billion, it means a certain confidence and a vote of confidence for Malaysian stocks and Malaysian companies.
Well, you know, just the conversation with Mr. Lee Han Ji this morning, the CEO of Kip REIT, he's quite optimistic. This is the right time to list. He's not worried about any concerns of a lackluster IPO market. And maybe, you know, there's something there. As he's saying, perhaps this year could be much better than last.
Yeah. And actually to note as well is that out of the 105 billion, only 7 billion is coming from the IPO market. So a very small proportion to the overall amount of money that's listed in that's raised in the market. The rest is coming from the secondary market through rights issue. And we know that investors don't like rights issue. It's considered a kind of overhang on the market. If you say that the market in Malaysia is worth right now about 1 trillion ringgit, so raising 100 billion in the market is considered, quote unquote, you know, 10% dilution of the market. Are investors happy to take this kind of dilution? Are investors happy to cough out more money to the extent of 10% their existing investments? It remains to be seen, but that was the figure that was achieved last year. So it may be easy to do that.
Some of the IPOs coming up this year include Serba Dynamic, HLT Global, Foundpack, and Perat Transit Berhad. Actually, quite a range of companies and sectors that they cover there.
Yeah, the Serba Dynamic is quite big, raising almost 600 million ringgit.
Engineering company, yes.
Exactly, through an IPO. And I guess that's in play at the moment. The construction gravy train continues. So such companies may find a lot of interest. And you just grilled a Kip REIT as well, which is raising not a small amount, about
230 odd million ringgit coming up. I think that IPO is coming out the first week of February.
Malaysian industry employers are calling for a one-stop foreign workers recruitment centre that is transparent and simple with a steady supply of labour in order to eliminate outsourcing agencies. This is very interesting because I think the key words here are transparent and simple. Because complexity actually creates opportunities for corruption, for the
costs,
bad distribution.
So, so the question that needs to be asked is, have we been overcomplicating the process for the past how many decades? Is the process essentially a simple one? And have we not been doing that? Why haven't we been doing it for the past few years?
And I think this quote from the president of the Malaysian Iron and Steel Industry Federation, So Tian Lai, is quite telling, because it reflects to me that the blame game has started, because he is saying that agencies were among the first, were among the factors behind the excess import, quote-unquote, of foreign workers.
Yeah, because they're making their money not on how these workers then go on and, you know, the kind of livelihoods they
not
make.
Not on a concrete policy.
They make their money on recruiting people, right? So the more they recruit, they're not concerned about labor demands in particular industries, right? They just want to make their fees.
And then we go back to technology, right? This is the age of fintech and this is the age of disruption. Do we need continue to need very costly agencies? Is that market ripe for disruption?
Well, do you think it should be privatized or under the government? This is a question, right? Do you think this is a matter of national interest that it should be parked under the government? Or could this be a private venture?
I think we need a government agency which is organized and which would provide clear policy as to how things are done as far as the hiring of foreign workers are concerned. This is not going to be very different from other government departments like the Income Tax Department, for example, or even the EPF, right? The EPF is not there to maximize profits as a profit center for themselves. The Income Tax Department really helps to collect government money and not really out there to make a money. They don't take a cut of the income tax being collected. So why should a unit like this profit from the hiring of foreign workers? I don't think I can accept that.
Well, you know, we only have to look at the big policy flip-flop of 2016 around that MOU with Bangladesh, you know, and I think we already see the what is going wrong with the system. Not only the fact that we had this G2G plus system that was never really explained, we also had very quickly after the announcement, you know, a company linked to the Deputy Prime Minister involved apparently, you know, and then there was a kind of flip-flopping on that. So, I mean, politics, policies, these things have become so intertwined that it's not clear what's leading. You know, these initiatives, is it politics and the needs of stakeholders and interested parties, or is it actually industry's needs?
Good question.
Okay, moving on, we go and look at Pesta Riang and the fact that it's teaming up with Alibaba.
Yeah, they want to launch this thing called EduCloud, which is to put education online. And I'm very optimistic about the future of education, because sooner or later, the cost of education will come down and people can go online to get high-quality educational material without going to the expensive traditional means. And also, it highlights the growth of cloud services from companies, very established e-commerce companies like Amazon and Alibaba. They have a lot of cloud space to spare. And therefore, they are doing their part of the CSR by going into education. If you look at cloud services revenue for Amazon under the AWS, Amazon Web Services, that's $8 billion as of 2015. And Alibaba itself, $500 million, not small amount, a very big cloud business that can add to their e-commerce business.
I think very contentious there, Julian, with your assertion about, you know, the future of education. I still believe in teachers. I believe in face-to-face interaction. The Socratic
when
math
you said that
method.
I knew you had some thoughts about that.
Who
pays somebody's
going
to pay for them, maybe the state, and it's a collective good,
okay,
right?
Another controversial point.
We will get back to that after the news. We'll have the opening numbers on the stock market and more analysis. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.